Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm speaking with Douglas R. Skopp, that's S-K-O-P-P, as in Paul, the author of Shadows Walking, a novel about Nazi Germany. Shadows Walking traces the lives of two fictional German doctors, childhood friends, one Protestant, one Jewish, in a series of flashbacks that extend from not long after the end of World War I through the Nuremberg trials of 1946. It explores the mental and emotional shifts that allowed doctors who had sworn the Hippocratic Oath to first do no harm to abandon their principles or justify their choices in such a way that they were able to participate in the horrifying medical experiments conducted on concentration camp prisoners under the Third Reich. In doing so, it complements my earlier interview with Julius Wachtel by again asking what role ordinary citizens play in the construction and maintenance of a totalitarian system, and to what extent any of us, under the right combination of circumstances, might choose to silence our consciences in support of a cause. When Shadows Walking opens, Johann Brenner, the Nazi doctor, is trying to escape from occupied Berlin. Chapter 1, 1946, Trials. Johann Brenner climbed inside the first boxcar he could find in Berlin's train yards as the city was falling to the Russians. When the train headed south toward Nuremberg, he cursed his luck. But he knew it could have gone east, deeper into the territory held by the Soviets, or into Russia itself. He knew that the war would soon end, if only the train were not bombed before he could jump off. His false papers afforded him a new identity, a new life. He wanted to go west, to Karlsruhe, where he hoped to find his wife. He was comforted by his belief that she had fled their apartment in Nuremberg to live with her sister in the Rhineland. He missed her, but their separation helped him forget what he wanted to forget. As the train neared Nuremberg, he jumped. American troops captured him within minutes. They brought him to a DP camp outside the city and assigned him and other displaced persons to one of the reconstruction crews at Nuremberg's Palace of Justice. But his war wounds, a leg injury resulting in an awkward limp from the First World War, and a scarred right hand, which he concealed with a glove, from the Second, made him unfit for hard labor. Instead, he worked as a cleaner inside the courthouse. He followed orders, did what he was told, and the Americans were satisfied. When the courthouse repairs were completed, Johann Brenner, now known as Heinrich Westermann, was selected to be the head custodian in Nuremberg's Palace of Justice. He liked his title. He assigned himself the night shift, 11 to 7. He appreciated the quiet. In the vast building, he alone was awake. He had a bunk, a small desk, and a cupboard under the stairs in the basement. He took his meals during the work week in the building's cafeteria. On weekends, he lined up at the nearby soup kitchen. Supervising the others, he felt responsible, even a bit important. Sometimes he hummed softly as he walked up and down the stairs. He alone knew that he had been a doctor at Auschwitz. And now, to tell us what happens next to Johann and his friend Philip, here is Douglas Skopp. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us today.
I thank you very much for putting me on and having this opportunity.
Great. We're going to talk about your novel, Shadows Walking, which I enjoyed very much, which is a study of Nazi Germany and, in a sense, how it came to be, the many decisions that were made by ordinary people that allowed the Nazi state to take power and hold power until the war. So I would like to begin, as I usually do, by asking you to tell us a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up? What was your training? What got you interested in the subject? How did you come to write this novel?
I grew up in Los Angeles. My mother and father divorced fairly early in my life, 6 months early into my life. And so my grandparents raised me with my mother's help. And they were Eastern European Jews who came to this country in the turn of the century and still preserved their religious traditions. And so I grew up in a Jewish household in Los Angeles. My grandfather had been a cobbler. Neither of my grandparents could read or write. I helped by reading them the newspapers and taking my grandparents to the synagogue. When it came time for me to go to college, I wanted to leave California, and so I applied to the farthest college away I could think of, and that was Dartmouth in New Hampshire. My grandparents had been very much affected by World War II and the Holocaust. Some of the family, some 30 people, hadn't managed to escape and were killed in the Nazi Holocaust. My grandparents, understandably, in my childhood, could only speak about the evil Germans. I was born in 1941 as we went to war. But I somehow knew that not everybody in every country was evil and not everybody in every country or people were good. So I developed a childhood pattern of questioning authority and challenging authority. When I went to Dartmouth, I came into the influence of a German professor who himself had fled Nazi Germany as a Jew, who had taught at Dartmouth until retiring. And I met him while working on a farm in Vermont, and he encouraged me to go to Germany and with books that he had written in German, which I was determined to read, but had enrolled in German 1 classes and couldn't very well. I could find out how the train station was, but I couldn't find out how to read philosophy. And so I went to Germany and dropped out of college and lived in Germany for a fair while. Attended the university there eventually after I learned German, and learned quite quickly that not every German had supported the war or been a Nazi, that many, including the family I lived with, had very courageously defended Jews and themselves had gone to concentration camp. So I came back to the United States, impressed by what I had seen in Germany, which was then just 15 years after the war, recovering from the war, its brutality, its cruelty, its destruction, and realized that if it could have happened in Germany, the war could have happened in the United States too. That the German citizenry had been excellent in all of its achievements, its Nobel Prize winners, its musicians, its philosophers, and yet a war had broken out and devastated the country. I feared that the same thing would happen in the United States, and so I came back determined to teach German history to college-age students, and went on for my PhD after Dartmouth. And focused on German history, German on education, on German education, and so came to the State University of New York at Plattsburgh, where I remained for most of my career, teaching and working with students and colleagues on helping them understand how something like the war in Germany could happen elsewhere.
That And you were at Pasteur. You were retired as a distinguished professor of history, as I understand. So you must have written a fair number of academic works, but you decided in this case to write a novel. How did that come about?
My academic work consisted of studies of the education of prominent physicians, engineers, mathematicians, school teachers, how they ultimately used their education to build their careers and gain professional authority and also serve political interests. But I knew from all those scholarly works that my own interest in how an individual physician, in this case, would become a Nazi wasn't really resolved. I, in the archives, found ample evidence for patterns of behavior, but no individual studies of individual values and ideas and aspirations and ambitions. And I was determined to write a novel in which I could review and explore some of those ideas. I wanted to get into the head of a German doctor. I had taught enough history and knew that students came alive when I used fiction in my courses. So I used All Quiet on the Western Front, for example, and helped students think about what had happened in the head of the Germans who were in that war. But I wanted to write something more intimate and more personal, and so I chose to write a novel. I also was concerned about all the scholarly work that had been done on Nazi medicine. When I was in Germany as a Fulbright scholar, some of these works already began to come out, and I knew that my work wouldn't be very much more than an amplification of theirs. I wanted to do something entirely original. And so in 1986, when I returned to the United States, I began working on the novel that ultimately became Shadows Walking, which was published in 2010. So it took me 25 years or so to write it.
Right. And that was the next point I wanted to get to. Once you decided to write a novel, how did you... It's quite a shift, I think, probably more than... Certainly that most historians realize, and probably even most of the general public realize, how much of a shift it is to go from writing academic history to writing historical fiction.
Yeah, I had been trained as a historian, so I was only allowed to say what I could actually find in the document, so to speak, or infer from the document what would be the fact of the story. But in the case of the novel, I could invent, I could create, I could be imaginative to the extent that the documents allowed, and then move beyond that. I'd always wanted to write fiction as a college student. I intended to major in history, in English, but instead majored in history. And so this was a blend that I could effect in my retirement. So in my final years of my teaching career, and then in my retirement, I focused more and more on creating the novel. I read many fictional authors. Dickens impresses me still with all of his imagination and his capacity to weave a story together in intensity. I read a lot of Russian novelists. I read Tolkien. I read, just about anyone I could read who had managed to weave a story together that was very intricate and related to somehow historical events. And that helped me enormously.
That's great. So did you work with other writers, or did you just keep revising it on your own until you were happy with it?
Well, I went through 11 different drafts. In the writing club that I have here in Plattsburgh that helps me, many of the members of the club watched each different draft and watched me stumble through them all, and I in turn helped them and learned from them. One of my best bits of advice came from a fellow historian who teaches at Berkeley, Peggy Anderson. She taught at Berkeley, Margaret Anderson. And she wrote a 40-page commentary on my, 10th draft, and had historical tips and characterizations and insights that could be used. And so I went back to square one then and rewrote the entire novel based upon her commentary. She's in many ways an invaluable critic. And I guess in some other ways I lived the story as best I could. When I wanted to immerse myself in the archives, I did so with such intensity that I found myself repelled and revolted and disgusted by the events that the archives revealed. And then I'd have to pull myself back out of that and go back to writing. And in each case, I had to return to the archives to confirm my evidence and restore my sense of perspective. And so it was a turbulent event, series of events in my life. Nothing in the story couldn't have happened the way I described it, or didn't happen the way I've described it. It's based firmly on historical archival material. I worked extensively during my Fulbright year on Nazi medicine. I went to Germany with the project of researching medical ethics and practices in Germany from 1880 to 1945, and wrote a scholarly piece about that, and then found a way to fictionalize the characters but keep it historically accurate.
I think writing groups are wonderful if you get the right one. I know mine has been invaluable because you get really hands-on advice that's directed at your particular work. And if you keep it going long enough, then people become almost as invested in your own, in your story as you are, which is wonderful.
Yeah, and in my case, the writing group was some 20 years long before I finished the project. Many other books were produced in the writing club before mine was produced, and some excellent people drifted in and out of the writing group during the time I was there.
But it reads very well. I mean, the effort that you put into it really shows. I think a lot of people release their works too soon, and they don't really do themselves a favor.
Now, but I think a 13th draft, a 12th draft would be even better. I've had different ideas about the story. There's another character I should have included. I should have made the friendship between Philip and Johann. Philip is the Jewish doctor. Johann is the Nazi, ultimately the Nazi doctor, the Protestant German doctor. I wanted to make them a little more textured, and I can see now ways in which I could have improved the book. I don't think anything has ever been written perfectly in any case, so I suppose mine's in good standing, but I still think of ways in which I could have improved it.
I'm sure there are always.
My wife is very happy that I'm finished it, I'm sure. She's was desperate to get out from under the shadow of my working under the stress of the book.
Yeah, I'm sure there are always ways things can be improved. And each draft and each novel gets a little bit better. You've set us up beautifully now to move into talking about the novel itself. It's not complicated to follow while reading, but it may be a bit hard for readers to follow if we talk about it in a linear kind of way on the air. So I wanted to note up front that the entire story is framed by a letter that Johann Brenner is writing to his wife, Helga, trying to explain what he's done since he saw her last, in part because he's been hanging out in Nuremberg, where she lives, for several months and perhaps even a year. I'm sorry if my memory is not perfect, but he then runs into her by accident at one of the trials being held in Nuremberg, and she's, of course, furious because he's been in this, to realize that he's been in the city all this time and he hasn't said anything to her or contacted her in any way. And so he's trying to explain why, and each time he writes a paragraph on this letter that opens up a series of chapters that describe the events that he's now compressed into two or three sentences in order to get across to her what he's been doing without, of course, you know, spending, he can't give her the whole book that is Shadows Walking, so he gives her this little extracts. And the book begins and ends in 1946 with these flashbacks into the past, which makes sense as you read through and read the portion from the letter. So tell us, explain as much of the plot as you would like readers to know, and I will interject the occasional question just to keep things going. But I don't want to take it past the point, you know, that a novel functions in part because readers want to know what's going to happen in the end. So I don't want to take it past the part where you will keep them interested in finding out what the end of the story is. And I'm going to let you decide where that is.
Okay, that's very good. First of all, you said, and I appreciate very much your saying that you enjoyed the book, but I don't think it's an enjoyable book in the sense that it's a happy story.
No, I enjoyed the writing of the book. I enjoyed the story, but the book, the topic of the book is tough going, I will admit.
It was painful to write, and I'm sure it's painful to read. I intended to weave the story of two physicians into their lives as they experienced the Nazi state. And so one is a Jewish physician, a German Jew, who has the childhood in a Bavarian village, shares his childhood experiences and his friendships with another boy in the village who becomes a doctor as well. That is the German Protestant. Together, a German Jew and a German Protestant in a Catholic German village probably had much in common, and so they share their experiences as, so to speak, outsiders amongst the Catholics in the village in Bavaria, and they swear an oath to each other to be blood brothers. And their story is intertwined, much like the snakes on the staff of the medical symbol that represents the medical profession. And their story unfolds as Johann is at the Nuremberg trial of doctors. He's a janitor in the courthouse where the trial unfolds through an accident of his escaping from Berlin. There in the audience watching the trial is his wife, his estranged wife with whom he's had no contact, Helga. And as they meet after one of the sessions of the trial, she is exasperated and angry with him for not seeking her out and yet having been in Nuremberg all the while. He decides to write her a letter, and that letter then becomes the theme-setting paragraph for each of the chapters. So in chapter 2, for example, he writes, "Dearest Helga, I fear I've lost my soul, and now you, for too long, fear has shamed me into silence. Now I must tell you what I've seen, what I've done, what I know others have done, why I thought what I was doing was so much good, and instead did so much harm. I don't know where it all began. Was it in Munich, while I was still studying medicine, when I first heard with my own ears the hissing hatred that brought this ruin down upon us? Was it in the First World War? Was it still after that? Oh, my beloved, even if it all began before we met, I must find the place and the time when I chose, when we Germans chose our terrible future. I remember shadows, and in those shadows spiders hatched. Venomous terrors were born. I know I was one." And so, as you said, the themes of each chapter are introduced by the chapters themselves. The titles of the chapters are taken from each segment of the letter. So this chapter, chapter 2, is titled Spiders Hatched. And it tells the story of Johann and then Philip as they experience World War One, the aftermath, the crisis of the economy and political uncertainty, the rise of Hitler's party in power, and how Johann at first thinks about designing a future within Nazi Germany for himself, in which he'll have a heroic role, one that he finds encouraged by the Nazis, and he decides to join the party, while Philip feels the pain and anguish and pressures of the party, which excludes him from his practice. And together, the two men weave their paths in and out of the regime, and ultimately encounter each other for the last time at Auschwitz. Meanwhile, Johann has involved himself in the eugenics movement, has begun to sterilize children of mixed-race parentage born to German women mostly at the end of World War I. And Philip has been excluded from practice by Nazi strictures and policies and the racial laws of the regime in 1935 cause him even further pain and anguish. It's a story in which I tried to get into the heads of the two physicians, the German doctor, Johann, and the Jewish German, Philip. And in both cases, tried to reveal how their choices ultimately led to their destinies. It's a book about choices and how each of us have the capacity, if we think enough about what we are able to do, and making those choices, might be able to avert our destinies and shape them in a different way.
One of the things I particularly liked about the book is that, as you say, it's about choices, and but not exactly the same kinds of choices, because Philip is, in a sense, he is responding to choices that are made for him because he's Jewish and for no other reason. And so his only real choice is whether to stay or go. But Johann is a very interesting character because he is not really comfortable with all of the Nazi line. And I hope you could talk to us a little bit more about what motivates him, because in some ways he's drawn to Nazi ideology. As you say, he participates in the sterilization program, the eugenics program, and yet he's never completely able to forget his childhood friendship with Philip. He doesn't really buy into the anti-Semitic ideology of Nazism.
Not entirely, and not wholeheartedly. In any case, he's turbulent and conflicted, and in fact a very weak character, insofar as he lets himself be used ultimately by the state. But his hesitancy and his resistance, if I can call it that, to do so at the outset makes him, I think, a relatively typical physician, Nazi physician, and makes him a typical member of the Nazi party. The power of the state to overwhelm them is evident for me, at least in his generation. Now, the younger generation, his son, Paul Otto, is much more willing to become a Nazi. He's, in fact, indoctrinated from an early age. But Johann is much more troubled by the arrogance of the party, by the cruelty that he sees it expressing, by the hostility towards the Jews, by the ambivalence that's in his own mind about whether it's the right thing to do or not. I had him joining and then not joining the Nazi party 3 or 4 times, which was typical of many of the physicians of the era, and in fact is documentable. But in the end decides that in his interest and in the profession's interest to best serve the state. And so he wholeheartedly, ultimately, decides to join. But it's a painful choice. And I have to say, whenever I was writing the character of Johann, I found myself revolted by what he was doing and had to surface and come back to my own world and my own life, and then plunge back again into the archives and rededicated myself to the story. was a terribly painful experience.
You mentioned that before, that you were revolted by the archives and you were revolted by the character of Johann, and I can certainly understand that because in my nonfiction writing life, I spent a lot of time reading about Nazi's atrocities, much more time than I would like because it's part of my work. Yeah. And it is extremely, I mean, to realize that human beings are capable of that kind of cruelty towards one another is a horrifying thing, and yet you were able to work through that. You were able to keep going, and this project must have meant a great deal to you.
Yeah, it was my life's work, I think, in a way, from my childhood on to now into retirement. And I think in some ways this was the project I needed to do throughout my entire life, to come to grips with who I could be, what choices I might make, how I, in fact, might have been a Nazi doctor, how only the barbed wire separated me from one life or the other, how in German history we could have a Mozart and a Mengele at the same time, realizing each man had aspirations and fears, and some managed to serve their better instincts and others managed to succumb to their worst instincts. I think, in fact, that's what the story is about, how each of us must find a way in which we can serve our better instincts and avoid our worst ones. Not having actually lived in the Holocaust and knowing what I would have done, I can only guess that I would have wanted to be a Philip rather than a Johann as a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But I asked my students in each case how they would have wanted to be, which side of the concentration camp wires they would have wanted to be on, and of course none of us can really know until we're faced with that judgment. But I think the test is trying to think ourselves into it and then finding the answer as best we can and hope that we will be the person we expect to be rather than one who's tempted by the evil of the era.
Yes, I think we all have a secret image that we're going to be, say, Solzhenitsyn, and instead most of us are the people in line queuing for onions, you know.
Yeah. And so I wish I had put into the story a character. Philip portrays a little bit of the resistance movement in that he buys postcards with Hitler's face portrayed on them and burns them in secret in the alleys of Berlin. But I wish I had drawn a sharper image of a resistance character and made a more enviable and noble a person who made a greater sacrifice than even Philip was able to make. Many of the resistance movements have such characters, but most of the Germans who chose resistance, for example, I think of my mother-in-law, whose life as a shopkeeper was a relatively insignificant one. But every year on Hitler's birthday, she'd put Hitler's picture into the show window of her store upside down until she'd be told by the local block leader, "Frau Schaut, what happened? You've put the picture of the leader in the window upside down." And she'd say, oh, I'm so sorry. It must have been a mistake." And she'd turn it back the other way. And that would be her feeble effort at a resistance movement. She didn't dare do anything different. Her daughter, my wife, was just a small child at the time. Her husband had been killed in the war, and that was as much as she dared do to survive as long as she could.
That incident made it into the book, as I recall.
Yes, it did. And indeed, many of the stories of my experiences in Germany. I lived there a long while. I studied there. I I had my Fulbright year there. I talked with many healthcare professionals from the era. I talked with many victims of the era. I talked with Nazi doctors as best I could. A lot of the book is woven together from that historical evidence.
Well, I suppose a resistance character would have been an interesting addition, but I have to tell you that, first of all, that story has already been done. And secondly, I think a resistance character might be too one-sided. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the book, and which really does make it, in a way, shadows walking, is that all of the characters are somewhat morally ambiguous. Some are more so than others. Johann is probably the most, not least because he's the main protagonist. But even Philip plays around early on with the idea of racially based medicine. He's drawn to that theory, which was quite prevalent in Europe at the time.
Yes, exactly, and was taught in all the medical schools of the Western world, not just in Germany, but in the United States. Racial laws were already in place in the United States before the Nazi powers came, the Nazi state came into being. A Nazi delegation came to the United States and studied the eugenics movement here and envied the laws that were in place in Kansas and in Vermont and in the southern states. Eugenics movement was part and parcel of 20th century medical education.
One of the things I think we should mention is that Philip has a German wife. I mean, they're both German, but she's a Protestant wife. And and also Johann's wife is much less, she's actually quite opposed to his joining the Nazi party.
Yes, so, and in fact, the women of the story are the heroic figures who see through the politics of the era and through the maniacal wishes of the Nazi party and have a better judgment, but who, as women, weren't honored for their political views as much as a man would be, and as a result, their views are disputed or are denied. Helga, in particular, would have been much more tolerant and even willing to appreciate Jews, but for Johann's disdain of them. The women in the story, Johann's mother, Johann's wife, Philip's wife, Christine, who's a Christian, and who stands up for Johann, for Philip at the Rosenstrasse protest and actually champions the movement to free her husband and many other Jews who had been taken to the Jewish Community Center in Berlin in a gesture of defiance of the regime. They are the heroic figures of the story.
And there are also characters in the story, Christian characters, who protect Christine and Philip at certain points in the story.
Yes, indeed. Not all the Germans, as I said, were monsters and Nazis. Many of the common citizenry knew Jews did what was possible to help them and were, in fact, quite heroic. When I first went to Germany, I lived on a farm in southern Germany in Lake Constance, and the owner of the farm was himself incarcerated for having liberated Jews. He and his family made uniforms for Jews who came to the farm and swam through Lake Constance and landed in Switzerland and then put on these uniforms and escaped that way. He's one of the righteous Gentiles, and he, in fact, was one who the German professor I knew at Dartmouth sent me to live with and where I learned my German.
Christine also wants Philip to leave. She urges him repeatedly to leave Germany, and yet he won't leave.
Yes. And in fact, he says several times, he's a German like anyone else. Why would he want to leave his homeland? Why should he? Why must he? just because the regime asks him to defer to its will and wishes. He is in no way any less a citizen, and as a result, he stays too long and is unable to escape. While many of his associates, Jewish colleagues, do leave and manage to escape. And in fact, Johann knows some of these who leave, and one of Philip's closest associates, a woman named Louise, a doctor, manages to go to Palestine at the time and urges Philip to leave as well.
One of the elements of that is that Philip doesn't leave in part because he can't imagine how bad it's going to become. And I think that that's a point that's really worth making. You know, it's easy to look back now and say, well, you know, the philosophy was there and Hitler was, these restrictions increasingly became stricter. And yet it would have been difficult, I think, if you were living at the time to imagine anything as awful as the Final Solution turned out to be.
Exactly. And in fact, I would applaud those Jews who thought they could stay and change the system as long as they stayed, except that they were doomed by the tyranny of the state. But few could realize how terrible it would become. I mean, the concentration camps were built as soon as Hitler came to power, and it was known that, children were told by their parents, you better be a good child or else you'll be sent to a concentration camp. That's as soon as he came to power. But no one really knew what was going on in those concentration camps at Dachau or in Buchenwald. And it was only later that the truth seeped out. It became known to the Western world in 1942. But until then, one couldn't really imagine that it was anything more than a relocation camp, a distant place where Jews would be sent for resettlement, but would be treated with every respect that they were due within the state that despised them. The British had built concentration camps in the Boer War. We had a concentration camp of a kind for the Japanese Americans in our war. It was thought that nothing serious in the way of a threatening experience would happen. You'd just be moved. Jews bought tickets on the trains that took them there in many cases. They took clean sheets. They took utensils. Here in the library in Plattsburgh State, we have on display two of the spoons brought to Auschwitz in a shrine, if you will, dedicated to the victims of the Holocaust here at the college. And those two spoons are taken from a field where there is an acre's worth of discarded cheap metal where the spoons that weren't able to be melted down into usable material for the war effort were cast away. And one of my colleagues brought them back from Auschwitz. He was given them by a curator at Auschwitz. And now we've made a shrine out of them. And those two spoons represent the desire to endure and survive and be able to have ordinary human experiences in the same way as any other human being would want to have them. Those that were sent to the camps were hopeful in every way of a better existence, or at least an existence long enough to endure past the end of the terrible, temporary, they thought, regime.
Which is tragic. Those details are tragic. I think that's one of the great things about a novel, as painful as it is, you can get those details in to make people really feel the sadness of the experience, the horror.
I invested a lot of energy in making sure that every detail in the story that I could control was authentic. I mean, when I say the park bench, they saw the sun setting over the church tower on the park bench at 5 o'clock in the evening, I know that the weather was good enough for them to see the sun setting over that park bench where that faced east in the park. I obsessed with the details of the story. In fact, in some ways, I escaped the story by obsessing into the details. There's a train schedule that works. The food, the smells, the atmosphere, the weather, the train ride itself. All of those are all based upon actual historical facts. As I say, there's nothing in the story that didn't happen or couldn't have happened exactly as I've described it.
That's the historian.
Yeah. And in some ways, I was escaping the story by finding those details. I mean, the actual story with the archival base of the atrocities and the sterilizations of the children. I have the stories of those children in the novel are based upon actual photographs of the children that were publicized at the time, of a little child wearing a sailor suit, mixed race child wearing a sailor suit. I describe him vividly in the story as best I can, but every time I tried to find the details, I was drawn back into the story. The hardest part about writing it was being Johann and finding myself doing the things that he did. And then I'd have to surface, and I'd take a break and come away, and I'd listen to Mozart, or I'd do some knitting, or I'd play with my dog. And then I'd go back into the archives and reread what Johann had done and re-immerse myself in the actual events of the story. And as long as I could stand it, I'd be Johann again, and then I'd overwhelm myself and come back out of it.
Let's talk a little more about Johann. You mentioned his son, Paul Adolf, who was initiated young into the Hitlerjugend in part through school. But he also has a daughter, and the daughter and the daughter's fate, I think, are particularly linked to I don't know that they drive his decision to get involved in the eugenics program exactly, but her illness and death are an important part in his transformation, I think we could say.
Yes, I agree. His daughter's name is Greta, and she suffers from polio, and she's paralyzed and ultimately dies. He's powerless to stop her illness and cure her, and realizes that that's a failing and a flaw in his own character that he had difficulty in overcoming, and he joins the Nazi Party in part to find his powers again. But ultimately, I guess the only way to say it is tortures similar children for their defects in the story. He's willing to admit that some of the problem is in his inability to help his daughter be well. But I don't think he wants to use that as an excuse. He realizes only later in his letter to Helga that it might have been a factor, but he's unable to separate himself from his sense of inability and powerlessness, and realizes that his arrogance as a physician inclined him to want to transcend that failure and overcome whatever hesitancies he has to join the Nazi Party and be willing to do what the Nazi Party is doing to the weak and the infirm and the paralyzed, those living lives without meaning or being useless leaders. Those were the people that he attacked as a physician. And yet his own daughter was one of those people.
Right. I can imagine he must have been a very difficult character. I mean, he's a difficult character to read, frankly, because he's, at the same time, he has this very strong sense of powerlessness. And yet it doesn't give him empathy, really, with the victims, except for his own daughter. And so it's almost like he's compensating for his powerlessness by attaching himself to this violent political power. And then he justifies his participation by saying, well, he's helping the race or he's helping humanity, and therefore he's not violating his medical oath.
Yeah. The Hippocratic Oath is a very disturbing aspect of the story. He violates the Hippocratic Oath from the get-go. He is unable to see the principle, the first principle of the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. And he had sworn that oath when he was in medical school. But now he's distorted the oath, and the Nazi Party medical community did exactly the same thing. They saw do no harm to the folk rather than to the patient individually. And so he realizes only too late that he has violated his oath and chosen to do no harm to the folk as a patient, if you will, which now needs to be purged of all of its weaknesses and flaws in the eugenics movement, but realizes that his lack of compassion and failure to realize that each individual patient is a human being is what has really brought him over the edge and into the brutality that he's done.
And it seems to me that that's the crucial difference between him and Philip, because when Philip is it Heidelberg, during an early internship, while he's not fully credentialed, but he's already gotten out of medical school, Philip is in a situation where his superior insists on punishing a child, basically, by sending him to a mental institution, even though the child is not mentally ill. And yes. Philip rebels. He refuses. He leaves the city and yes. abandons that job. That's the difference yes. between the two of them.
Yes, exactly. And Philip shows compassion and concern and patience with the mother and of the child and an understanding. And Johann sees the child only. Johann would see another child as a member of the folk, either healthy or unhealthy, and would regard it as does the doctor who supervises Philip as a non-wholesome element in the folk's eugenics period. This is a turning point in the story, if you wish. The doctor, by the way, is an actual figure. Many of the characters in the story are actual figures. The doctor under whom Philip studies at Freiburg, not Heidelberg, but Freiburg, is an actual figure. His name is Dr. Hoche, and he, together with a lawyer, write a book called The Permission to Destroy Life Not Worth Living. That book comes out in 1920. It's a small book, and it becomes a seminal study for all of the medical profession, in which it allows the physician to take steps to destroy lives not worth living. The term is taken directly from the book. Also, the same book has the term useless eaters. And after World War I, Germany was faced with a declining birth rate and saw its needs to accept stringent methods to perfect and purify itself for a future that it expected for itself, and thought itself able to generate a medical philosophy that would, in fact, help all of humankind in the same way that animals had been bred to be better animals and dogs had been bred to be pedigreed and so on, thoroughbred horses and the like. These would make better human beings. And so the eugenics movement involves itself in this negative, punishing of those living not lives not worth living or defective in some way or another in the eyes of the authorities. And Hoche advocates this policy right on through into his later life. But Philip resents it and rejects it and ultimately is a victim of it.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because one of the things I want to mention as we wind up the interview is that I understand that you have available on your website, www.shadowswalking.com, 70 mini-essays in PDF format for people who would like to learn more about the individuals and the places that you describe in your novel?
Yes, there's a series of persons, places, incidents, and circumstances that I've written little historical blurbs, I guess, paragraphs or several pages, if you wish, about, and one of them is Hoche, Klauberg, Goebbels, Brandt, a doctor who is the head of the Nazi medical establishment at the end of the war and brought to trial in Nuremberg, and other circumstances like Jews in Germany and the Kristallnacht and so on. All of those are on my website, and the list is in the back of the book, but it's also on the website as well. And those PDF essays can be accessed directly by going to my website, www.shadowswalking.com, one word, shadowswalking. And the reason that I put them there is that I wanted to remain a historian, even while writing a piece of fiction. I wanted to demonstrate the validity of my sources. I wanted to cite them. I wanted to include them as evidence. I thought at one point of doing a novel with footnotes, and then I thought another time of doing it with parallel pages. On the one side, the novel, and on the other side, a history of the medical profession. I got very convoluted projects in my mind. And in the end, these little essays, 70 of them, represent my effort to document what I found to be true and the archival material. They also include bibliographic essays that would provide further reading on, I think, six different major subjects, such as Jews in Germany and World Wars and Nazi government and policies, etc.
And are these also the characters who became the basis of Johann and Philip?
Johann is based on three or so Nazi doctors, one of whom is the doctor he serves, who was an actual person at the camp in Auschwitz. That's Dr. Schumann, who supervises the X-ray sterilizations of men in the camp. He's an Air Force officer and is an actual figure. Horst Schumann escapes Germany after the war, goes to Africa with his wife, sets up a jungle clinic in Uganda, is protected by Idi Amin, and then ultimately a journalist from Germany hears of his jungle hospital, goes there and writes a story with photographs about this wonderful German doctor who is serving the natives in Uganda, and publishes the photographs in Germany in the 1960s. And some of Schumann's actual victims recognize him, men who have been sterilized. And after a while, he is extradited to Germany after Idi Amin's death, is brought back to trial in Munich, and is defended by an attorney who claims that he's too ill to stand trial, and ultimately he dies without having ever gone to trial. Schumann's one of the doctors on whom Johann is based. Johann would have gone to Africa if he could have escaped at the end of the war and set up such a clinic.
I'm sure he would have. That's a great story. You can't really make stuff like that up.
No, I didn't make it up. Another doctor in the story who is an actual figure is Klauberg, who sterilizes women brutally and viciously at Auschwitz. He's a very famous gynecologist before the war, and in fact, some of the instruments that he devised are still in use in gynecological experiments. He specialized in fertilization before the war, helping women become fertile. Then he turns his attention to making them become infertile after the war, or in the camp at Auschwitz. He has an enormous laboratory and clinic in Auschwitz in which he experiments on Jewish women, rendering them sterile and brutally doing it. And Johann's invited to visit one of those procedures, which he does. Klauberg escapes after the war and is finally brought to trial and is found dead in his cell waiting for trial. The suspicion is that others who knew more about what he had done and what they had done too, as doctors, arranged for his murder.
So what, I suspect I know the answer to this, but I think it's worth reiterating, even if it is something that you said already. What would you like readers to take away from your novel?
How this evil is capable for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
How we all, within the context of the world in which we live, could be led to make choices that do harm to others. How compassion and awareness of our own instincts must guide us better than we are guided. That every page of history is a bloody page, and that if we are ever to escape ourselves by doing anything that can redeem us, it will be in a recognition of our need for compassion, our love for others, our recognition of the worth of others as much as the worth of ourselves. Those are the lessons. It's a cautionary tale, I suppose, that I wanted and feel still the need to tell. High school class nearby in Lake Placid, New York, has chosen to read the book. Now there's two different classes have read it, an English literature and social studies class combined, honors class, advanced placement class, with two excellent teachers. And these young students, 16, 17, 18 years old, are finding my book accessible, meaningful, are seeing things in it that I am hardly aware of ever writing into it. They've seen the themes of the book very clearly. They are our future, these young people. And I must say it's been among the most exhilarating experiences of my teaching career now in my retirement to travel often to the school and have them visit the college here where we have a fairly extensive memorial set up for the Holocaust named in honor of my wife and me. And these young people are our future, and hoping that they see the story for the truths that I have tried to weave into it, the evidence of our own need for each other, our own compassion for each other, and the possible hatred that we might exercise if we aren't aware of that. That's the message I want to impart.
That's wonderful that it's being adopted. In classrooms. And what about you personally? Where do you go from here?
Well, I'm enjoying my life to the extent that I can enjoy it. I have cancer, as it turns out, a rather unusual form, kidney cancer, and I've been chosen to be an ambassador to other patients with kidney cancers and speak with them about our effort to overcome the disease, or at least endure it as long as we can with quality of life. And so I'll be traveling this weekend to Cambridge to a meeting that organizes us around that theme. I'm writing poetry. I'm knitting a lot. I'm having a stained glass panel that's nearing construction and enjoying piecing that together and making it. My wife and I have an interest in our gardens and in our cat, and my grandsons, all five of them, keep me hopping whenever I can be involved in their lives. It's a real treat. My eldest son, eldest grandson, is a master chess player already, and he beats me every time he can. And whenever I can even just, out of 200 games, gain a half a victory, I'm thrilled. So he's 15 years old, and these are wonderful, wonderful young people in my lives. Life is good.
That's great. Thank you so much for fitting us into your schedule, and we wish you all the best. I know that
thank
it's
you.
Very tough, but thank you.
No, it, life is what we make it, and it's not our it's not events, but our attitude toward them that we can control. So I'm being given a card that I didn't ask for in my hand, but I'm doing my best with it, and I'm grateful for every opportunity I have to be influenced by others and to help them with whatever I can show them as truth. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Carolyn. I appreciate very much this opportunity. It's been a wonderful experience for me.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Goodbye, Doug.
Bye-bye.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I am C.P. Leslie, host of New Books in Historical Fiction, and today I've been talking with Doug Skopp, author of Shadows Walking. You can find out more about him and about the people whose stories became the backbone of his novel at www.shadowswalking.com. His book is available for purchase through Amazon.com. Goodbye for now, and thank you for listening to New Books in Historical Fiction.